This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders, past and present.
This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters Series.
Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by Alan and Unwin, and we are delighted to be talking to Heather Rose about her memoir of loss and discovery, Nothing Bad Ever Happens Here. Heather Rose is the Australian author of 8 novels, writing for both adults and children. Her books have been shortlisted, longlisted, or won awards for literary fiction, crime fiction, fantasy sci-fi, and children's literature. Her 7th novel, The Museum of Modern Love, won the 2017 Stella Prize and the Christina Stead Prize. And her most recent, Bruni, won the ABIA Fiction Book of the Year. Heather lives by the sea in Tasmania. Welcome, Heather.
Hello, Catherine. It's lovely to be with you.
A massive congrats on Nothing Bad Ever Happens Here. I absolutely devoured it. It is moving and joyful and sad and uplifting, but I think it's also instructive. For listeners that haven't been able to read it yet, how do you describe it?
Oh.
Tough questions off the bat.
Yes, straight off the bat. How do I describe it? I describe it, well, it's a collection of stories born from events that awakened me, enlivened me, enriched me, and ultimately continue to nourish me.
And when did you know that you wanted to write this book, and how did you begin?
Well, some of the stories I've had a long time. So there's a story of me taking my son on the Overland track when he was 13, and he's 33 now. So some of those stories had been brewing. I'd never really finished them. And others I'd never dared to write about. So when I turned 50, I was very unwell at the time, and I thought I ought to write these stories down. My children had been asking me, lots of friends had been asking me to write down these stories, and I thought I'll do it now, because if anything happens to me, at least, you know, we'll be safe. They'll be safe with these stories, and maybe it will be helpful to them as they go on in life and for their children to know who I was. So that's where it started, but then it took a long time. It was hard. It was much more emotionally challenging than I could ever have imagined.
As you've mentioned, Heather, the book includes events from right across the kind of full span of your life. How did you record these events when they happened?
I have a huge trunk full of journals that go all the way back to my teenage years. And yes, I'm a prolific journal keeper, and they're all different colours and fabrics and patterns and sizes. There's so many of them. And that was very, very helpful. Often quite surprising too, because the things I remembered, I hadn't even bothered to write down.
That's so interesting.
I know. I was focused on other things, I think. And then every now and again, I'd find these passages and I'd think, oh, yes. And that would become part of, you know, a chapter in the book. It was just like, oh, it'd just been waiting for me.
Oh, how fascinating. In terms of the journal writing practice, what does it look like for you? What form do your entries take? Where do you write? How often do you write?
Oh, I wish I had one close by, because we're moving house at the moment. Everything is up in the air. But I, these days I allow myself moleskin journals. They're hardbacks. Oh. I like the little hardback with the, you know, stretchy thing on there around the outside, so I can keep a pen in it and those useful tear-off pages at the back. And I scrawl. I just scrawl. I have an almost illegible scrawl, so I always think that was a good thing to develop, because it keeps my writing quite private should anyone discover it. And I'm a very incoherent person, I suspect. I love to take notes. I love to jot down conversations I've heard or sentences that have arisen, parts of the world I'm visiting and what I'm observing in terms of the smell and the colour and how the clouds look today. I might jot down some notes when the next novel comes through. I'll be, oh, Caroline, and I'll put Caroline up the top, and then I'll write about Caroline. So as I go back through them, I can find the pieces that are for the novel or pieces that are for some future work or just pieces that I want to have, you know, in my mind, just ruminating on to consider how I can make use of that in the future.
I love that.
And sometimes I think just for freedom, Catherine. I mean, do you do that?
I have just started doing morning pages this year and I am amazed at how much I love it.
It's a brilliant practice. It's one of the things when I have students, I really enthuse them to get into morning pages.
I think it's a bit addictive. As I said, I'm surprised how much I enjoy it.
Yes, and the trick is to never read them back.
Totally. Yes. I am throwing each book away as I complete it.
Yeah, it's really powerful. I watched a friend keep a journal of morning pages for about 6 months, and then he went and read them back and he really gave up trying to write because he thought he was, you know, that was his writing. No, that's your mind clearing for the writing.
They can be very repetitive too and very mundane.
Very mundane. Today I'm doing the washing.
Exactly. If we circle back to Nothing Bad Ever Happens Here, this is a book that details multiple very profound and deeply spiritual experiences. What is the hardest bit about taking something that is deeply personal and, in your case, often otherworldly and making it public or making it into something for other people to read?
The hardest thing was navigating the emotional territory. I had to go find myself back at 19 in a monastery, and I had to go find myself back in my 20s in those Native American ceremonies in the Midwest and the Southwest of America. And I had to find that vulnerable but courageous girl that I was. And that was hard, Catherine. It was hard. I mean, I'm nearly 60 now, and I know this seems something of a trope, but I didn't really understand my life until I wrote the memoir in some ways. And I hadn't expected it to be that sort of process. You know, it's my ninth book, and every book takes everything, as I say in the memoir. But this one took much more because it was mining the threads that were born of tragedy, the threads that were born of joy, all these threads that went on into my life having such a powerful impact on me and the choices I made. And I hadn't seen it like that before.
What do you tell yourself when it gets hard?
It'll get better.
And do you think about the audience? Do you have someone that you imagine yourself to be writing for?
I don't have a single person, but I trained as a copywriter in advertising in Melbourne. And so I did that for 10 years. And that is such a craft in itself because it trains you to consider your audience, and it also trains you to make sure that when you write, it will keep people literally reading to the bottom of the passage and seeing the brand on the bottom right-hand corner. You know, that's the old-fashioned trick of copywriting. And it took me a long time to get out of that because it's a very fast and tight form of writing. So writing a novel is almost the antithesis of that. But with the memoir, because I have never written a long nonfiction piece before, that was a really big learning curve too. So what I found is I just have to come back to the craft over and over again. What is it that is going to forward this? What is it that is going to keep the reader engaged? I'm conscious, acutely conscious. I'm working in a world now where there are 1,000 distractions, and for a reader to keep reading your book is such a gift of their time, and it's such a gift in the face of so many other alluring distractions, all the online delights that people engage with, including fantastic movies and TV series and the microverse of, you know, social media. So it's a big challenge, I think, for us writers these days. And for that reason, I was really conscious I did not want to labour anything in the book, but I also didn't want to dismiss the depth of the experiences that I'd had. So it was very, very difficult. I would not recommend writing a memoir to anyone.
Really?
I really wouldn't. Yes. It's a re-traumatising process. And if you're willing to be re-traumatised and And ultimately, there has been a sense of healing, and there's been an enormous sense of healing in my family. My dad loves it. He said, Heather, we all needed you to write this book.
It must be the best reader feedback you can get, really, isn't it?
Oh, I was so touched, so touched. He actually has said it in a little film that the ABC have filmed, so it'll be out at some point, and everybody will be able to see what a beautiful man my dad is.
That's beautiful. Heather, the overwhelming sense that you get in reading this book is what a life you have lived. There are opium dens. There are extremely long periods of time spent in monasteries, in a monastery. In fact, at one point, you actually thought you might stay forever. There is the sun god dance and sweat lodges. You've gone to really extreme lengths in your spiritual pursuits. And often in those pursuits, there is this physical element. So the sun dance and the ripping of skin, for example, is probably a better way of putting it. Why do you think that the physical part is important in seeking spiritual truth or learnings? What role does it play?
It's a great question. I do think pain is an elevating factor in those experiences. Any kind of physical hardship pushes us beyond our normal character. And we see, you know, parts of our character we might not like to acknowledge usually. So when things get tough, if we're deprived of water for a period of time, it's interesting to notice how quickly one begins to panic. And deprived of food, deprived of sleep, any of those extreme experiences, you know, of course, other hardships that I explain in the book that I entered into willingly, they help to release us from our sense of ourselves as a fixed being, I think. And we start to see other parts of ourselves emerge. And once I started to realize that that was possible, I think that became very curious to me. And I didn't mean to do so many hard things. In fact, when I looked back, I actually felt a little bit sorry for that girl in her 20s who was putting herself in such extreme circumstances. But I'm also so grateful because it's only from those experiences that I've become the person that I am now, obviously, but also I think they helped me understand what my priorities were and what really mattered in life and what didn't. And the creative life that I've had has been, you know, it's a rigor. We both know that from writing a novel. A novel is a rigorous process. It's a marathon. And you have to get past your fear. And in fact, I think we have to get past our fear in so many ways. And if we can, it gives us such an enormous sense of freedom.
It works as a life lesson. I'm interested, a contrast to the type of physicalness that is coupled with spirituality is your experience of chronic illness. And it's something that you write about towards the end of the book, about how pain is sometimes a backdrop to life, but other times very much in the foreground. And I kind of wonder about the contrast between these two things, the pain that you experience from chronic illness and the pain that you can experience from spiritual pursuit. Are these things so different that they just don't warrant comparison? Or are they similar in some ways, different in others? Is the mental approach required to endure or survive the same or different?
I think it's exactly the same. And I think that if we... So for the listeners, I have since childhood had a chronic form of arthritis, and it has caused me to be unable to walk for weeks and months on end throughout my life. It's excruciatingly painful when it happens and its flares happen, but then I get better and life goes on. And the challenge of that has been learning to understand what it is I have to create in myself emotionally to be able to live with the pain. And, you know, there's not a day I don't have pain, but there are many, 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 many days that I can be an entirely joyful person without being aware of the pain. So I've had to learn a lot of mindfulness to cope with that, and to live with that and actually to rejoice in it. I know writing the memoir, that was the hardest chapter to write because I didn't want to share that at all. I've tried to keep it very private. But it seems such an essential thing, considering how many people are also suffering with chronic illness, be that mental or physical, in our society, and especially in Australia at the moment, the epidemic of mental health issues is so concerning to me, in our young people especially. And so finding a way to accept that this is so, to surrender to what's so, but then to create a me that I like being in the midst of that. And that's where I got to choosing joy. I found that the more joyful I could be, so using mindful techniques, meditating, elevating my emotions into a joyful state, regardless of what circumstances my body was in, also had a dramatic impact on how the pain was able to dominate me.
Mm. Joy is a really recurrent theme throughout this book. Heather, one of the things that was pointed out to us on the podcast recently was that we don't hear enough about what writing looks like from the perspective of someone who has chronic illness. So for you, how have you managed to write and to have a writing career around various health impacts and issues?
Well, there's the journals, yeah. You can write a lot in bed. The hard bit is when the drugs take me away. And for a long time, there were opioids and various forms of opioids and, you know, the dreaded codeine and all of those things just to manage my day, cortisone, you know. Luckily these days I have the biologics, these injections that help a great deal. And my gift has been medical marijuana, which has made it possible for me to be an entirely creative person, entirely feel like myself, but it just diminishes the pain. And I'm so grateful to the people who've done all the work on that, and it, really enraged by Australia's policies about that. If I go to America, I can get all the pain medication I need that way, and none of it has a long-term effect on me. None of it has a lingering effect. I'm not addicted to it. You know, it has nothing like the same effects that the opioids or the codeines do. And I still feel vibrant. And that's what we lose when we have chronic illness. I think we lose our vitality. And that's the source of our creativity too. So it's incredibly difficult to keep writing in the face of excruciating pain or suffering, as chronic illness is. It's also an invitation, I think, within the moments of chronic pain to do that automatic writing we talked about before, to really let loose on the page with everything. Sometimes all I could do was write down all the drugs I'd had to take that day. That was all that I had in me. But when I looked back at those, when I found them again in the trunk of journals, it gave me a sense of being such a survivor. And I think if we can tap into that when we have chronic illness and say, it takes a lot of courage to have a chronic illness, but it is also a sacred role to access empathy for other people. It's a hallowing presence in its own way. It has the sacred in it if we let it in. And it's not because, you know, it's something that's been visited upon us because we have bad karma or because God doesn't love us. In fact, I think quite the opposite. I think so many of us live with pain and suffering because there's been so much trauma in our lives one way or another. And there is a lot of trauma in society right now. If you're not noticing that the world is having a massive problem in terms of politics and the environment, then you're not awake. So it's not any wonder that we are suffering in the ways that we suffer. But to choose to do that with empathy for our fellow human being and with huge empathy for the planet, I think that's the invitation for me.
Heather, you mentioned the environment. I want to talk about the role of art in relation to other aspects of life. You've been involved across a long period of time in protesting the logging of Tasmanian forests, from protesting against the sponsorship of an arts festival by Forestry Tasmania to putting up an anti-logging billboard in Sydney about forests and logging that was taken down after 4 hours. These issues have only gotten worse over time. I think we really understand the role of science in climate change and environmental politics. What do you see as the role of art?
Keep bringing attention to these things. Keep alerting people in all the different ways we can. And that's not to be didactic, because there's nothing worse than reading something that's didactic. it's to consider what it means. I mean, one of the reasons that I'm going back 200 years in the next novel is to actually look at how on earth did we get here? What was it about the birth of industrialization? What was it back in the 16 and the 1700s that caused us to go into the 1800s where we've got colonialism rife in Australia? We've got all the new mechanization of the world that took workers out of their homes and put them in these dreadful factories for extraordinary hours of the day. There are so many things that have caused us to get here. And I think looking back is helpful. I think looking at now and the impact it's having on people now is really helpful. And then looking into the future, I'm super interested to see what people start to create for futuristic writing. And, you know, we write what's in our hearts. I think that's what's so, isn't it? You know, and if that's in the heart of the writer, then find a way to bring it to the attention of people. It's important.
One of the things that you mention about writing in the book, Heather, is that you need weather for writing. I have never heard someone say that. What weather do you need?
Oh, Tasmanian weather. I need it all of it. I need it wild one minute and calm the next. Yesterday, the morning started off sort of incredibly beautiful blue sky, few low clouds, mirror calm sea, exquisite little waves just frolicking on the shore. Within about an hour, a wind had come in. By midday, I was in a hailstorm with these almost 5 cent pieces sized hailstones falling on my car. And then it was windy and rainy all afternoon. And then it came out beautiful again. And we had the most extraordinary sunset that was full of those. It's almost like someone from the 1600s had come and painted the clouds that night. They were pink and blue and soft, and golden light was everywhere. And that's a day in Tasmania. That's what I love. It makes me feel alive.
I love that. Heather, we have a lot of writers that listen to this show. What is either the best or the worst writing advice that you've ever received?
Great. Well, the worst writing advice I ever received was, you'll never make any money out of that, which is such a common one. And we really have to break that down for ourselves, because yes, I didn't make any money out of writing for a very long time. I've only been able to be a full-time writer since the Museum of Modern Love won those beautiful prizes and I got a grant from the Australia Council to write my 8th novel. But that's the only way I've been able to work full-time since then, and thank goodness for a readership. But, you know, in Australia it's small and we're all supplementing with other forms of income. Very rare for an Australian writer to be able to support themselves by their writing. And I'm very lucky that I have a wonderful partner in the last couple of years. So that's really changed my life in that regard, who totally supports me through those periods of, you know, absence of income, which we, you know, I don't know if many people understand this, but writers get paid twice a year. We get, and you never know how much it's going to be. So, you know, it could be literally I received a check once for 57 cents and it was in a 60 cent envelope. So, you know, it can be nothing or it can be a great deal.
That's and so bad, isn't it?
It's so bad. But how could you make, how can you, you know, and I do feel for us because we don't have any kind of MacArthur or Guggenheim fellowships that give, you know, our writers the chance to do 3 or 5 years on a project. And I think our cultural life would be enriched so much if we had that opportunity in Australia to watch what people might do if they were, if their mortgage was taken away from them, and if they could focus on a long work that required years of research. You know, some of the best, if you look down the list of the Guggenheim Fellowships and the MacArthurs, the writers that were on that and the books that were written, it's truly extraordinary. So don't believe about the money. Do what you love, the money will follow. That's what I love. But the best writing advice, a writer writes. Yeah. And you know who gave me that? Billy Crystal in the movie Throw Mama from the Train.
Really?
Yes. That's what he used to say to his students, a writer writes. And
I can hear his voice saying that as he says it.
And it's as simple as that when all is said and done, a writer writes. You're not writing if you're doing the dishes, you know. I mean, you can be thinking about stuff, but unless you spend a concerted amount of time, 6, 8, 10 hours a day, sitting down at your desk, writing the thing you're meant to be writing, it's not going anywhere. People don't understand that it is a marathon. It's going to take thousands of hours.
Our final question, Heather, can you recommend a favourite book by a debut author? It can be any author from any time, any genre.
I instantly went to Kate Krumink's, K.M. Krumink. She's a Tasmanian author, A Treacherous Country. I think for a first novel, that is a truly extraordinary evocation of place and time and character. Has a beautiful plot too. Really, really well done. But the other one also is Bridget Crack by Rachel. I've forgotten her last name. Isn't that terrible?
Leary.
Rachel Leary. Oh, I feel so sorry. Sorry, Rachel, sorry. But her book, Bridget Crack, is such a beautiful evocation, again, of historical Tasmania, but it's told from the perspective of a woman in the midst of colonialisation and bushrangers and all of that, and I had never seen that world before, and she does it so beautifully also. Those two instantly come to mind.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.